Okay, this is us, and today is June 12th, 2012, and we're still in Matthew chapters 5. We're just about to finish up chapter 5, 6 and 7 of Sermon on the Mount, and today we hope to look at the majority of Matthew 5, 38 to 48. So we're I need to seek your permission to be recording this session, and if you're in favor, just give us an amen.
Amen.
Okay, good. Let's read it from the top of 538. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun, S-U-N, rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet their brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Okay, well, we're not going to make it all the way through this. And you notice we've got how many pages? Seven?
Yeah.
Seven pages.
Yeah, okay.
Seven full pages. And we'll probably make it through 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 verses.
Uh-huh.
But there's a lot going on there.
Mm. Yeah,
and it's worthy of our time.
It's just
it certainly is.
Slow it down.
So verse 38. You have heard that it was said. Now, I want to point out, sometimes, you know, we talk about active, middle, and passive voices. And I keep driving that home because that's all we got in voices. And the most unique to our way of thinking is the middle voice. But we should have no problem with understanding passive and active. So when we have a contrast in one sentence with active and passive, we've got essentially two different things going on. And we have that here. You have heard is active. Active voice.
Mm-hmm.
Now you would think you have heard would be passive, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so he's basically saying you are hearing. I mean, right?
It's aorist tense, so it's the past idea in a punctiliar form. You know, like somewhere along the way in the past, you have heard this. Mm-hmm. You have heard this, but it's in an active voice. You have heard it. You have. So, in other words, it wasn't just put upon you. You heard it with your intellect, with your mind, with, you know, you were actively participating in this as you heard it. It didn't go in one ear and out the other. You were participating in it. And it's important. It sounds like, you know, well, that's being kind of picky, isn't it? No, it's not. Especially since the phrase that follows, it was said. That's passive.
Mm-hmm.
It was said. Now, all along we've had these things in various forms,
yes,
of various lengths. You have heard that it was said to the ancient peoples. That's what it actually says. It's not necessarily. A few verses prior to this, we have more of the extended full vocalization of this address. You have heard that it was said to the ancients, is what it literally says in the Greek, to the ancients. The ancients has a definite article, and then ancients is an adjective. But you don't put a definite article before an adjective until that adjective is used to modify or becomes a noun itself. It's a common occurrence to make an adjective into a noun, and that's called a substantive use of the adjective. The adjective that is used to describe something, it's a descriptive term, slow, fast, heavy, light, right. Ancient, new, those are all adjectives. New what? We ask the question, new what? To the ancients, plural, ancients. What? Ancient ones.
Ancient ones.
Ancient peoples, if you will. Ancient peoples. Now, when you have an adjective that's used as a substantive, if it's in the... there are three tenses that it could go into. Masculine, feminine, and neuter. When it is in this kind of structure, as it is in this, this is dative case, by the way, to the ancients. Now, what is it? Dative case! It's a dative case, all right. And it is the indirect object, to the ancients. You have heard that it was said to the ancients. This is in a passive form. It was said to them. They didn't say this themselves. Okay. It was said to them. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's in the passive form. But when we look at, read it as it's translated here, that it was said doesn't fulfill that whole, the whole story. That's an abbreviation. That's a truncated or what we call elliptical sentence. There's more. And Jesus has already given us more previously. In fact, he started off giving us the whole enchilada,
yeah.
You know, to the same kind of formula. And then sometimes he said, you heard, and you heard that it was said.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times it's this whole, again, I say to you, you have heard that it was said to the ancient people.
Yeah.
Now, let me get back to where I left off. The three forms of this substantive use of the adjective can be in the masculine gender, feminine gender, and neuter gender. Now, the author, the one who's writing this or speaking this, has to choose one of those three.
Yes.
Since there's a choice, there is a significant difference between it. It's not random. I'll use feminine today, and then maybe tomorrow I'll make all my adjectives neuter, and then the day after that, why not go masculine gender for that? Well, so here he is. Jesus chose the form of the masculine. If the substantive is masculine gender, it refers to people. It is personified. That's why we have the ancients is referring to the antecedent for this. What it is actually, the adjective is is pointing to is plural ones. Plural ones. So that would be peoples.
Yeah.
Right. Persons. If it is in the feminine, let's take the neuter gender first. Neuter gender first. It refers to things.
Mm-hmm.
Things. And you can do that. You have heard that it was said to the ancient things.
Oh.
That doesn't make sense, but that's what it would be. Mm-hmm. The ancient things. But it could be a different kind of sentence. And if it said ancient, and it was in the neuter gender, then we would be looking for an antecedent or, you know, what it's modifying in pointing to in terms of things.
Okay.
Things. Now, the feminine gender always refers to some noun in the feminine gender. And there, you have to know your language to know the nouns in the feminine gender that it would be pointing to. For example, in Scripture it says that Jesus went up into the mountainous. It doesn't say he went up into the mountains. It says he went up into the mountainous. Adjective, mountainous. Mountainous what? We have to ask that question.
Yes, yes.
What's it pointing to? Mountainous. Mountainous. It's mountainous there is in the feminine gender. So we're looking for a feminine gender noun that comes to our mind immediately. It's not a puzzle.
Uh-huh.
It's just he went into the mountainous. And we're supposed to know, they did, what he's referring to. Region. Is feminine gender. He went up into the mountainous region. That's it. It's just that simple. But you see, there's a class distinction between the use of the feminine, neuter, and masculine genders for that. He didn't go up into the mountainous people, although he could. That's doable.
Yeah.
Mountain people? Yeah. Mountainous people,
mm-hmm.
Except people the idea of people, you know, is masculine gender. Okay, so I don't want to get too more confusing about that, but we have a clear distinction here that we know it's not referring to time, ancient time, to the ancient time. You have heard it was said to the ancient time. Because time, you don't speak to time.
No.
And time is not passive to receive the speech. So it's very clearly the ancient peoples. Who are the ancient peoples that would be referring to?
Jews.
Exactly. Yeah. Just that simple.
Yeah.
They are the ones who receive in a passive way the word of God. So he's saying, now, you will see, if you did any research on this, if you happen to do this, you will find some people saying that maybe it refers to, well, many of them will say ancient time, or they won't even use ancient. You have heard it to say those of the old time, or time of old, and things like that. In fact, some translations do say that. But we know it's referring to people because it's masculine gender. And others would say that, let's see. That it was said as if it was active. You have heard that it was said. As if somebody was just saying, I've got a good one. Here, listen to this. And then say what they're going to say. obviously that's not, it wasn't human generated. This is referring to what the humans received, and specifically the ancient people, these Jews, received from God. So it wasn't a human attitude or a truism, proverb of man, all that stuff. And yet you will see that sometimes they say that Jesus is correcting a misunderstanding. And I don't agree with that, because unless they totally misunderstand the word of God, he's referring to a misunderstanding. But he's referring to, you have heard that it was said to the ancient peoples. And you heard, yeah, this qualifies them as not necessarily Jews. They could be, they had heard it said. If they were Jews, yeah, they had heard it said, because they're their people. But they could be Gentiles. So it reaches the vast amount of audience, a vast audience in this statement. You can be a Jew or Gentile when you hear him say this.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, you have been given this truth from God, or this command from God. It doesn't say that.
No.
Because the Gentiles were not given this command from God. A people selected from the peoples of the world were given this command. Those who wanted to align themselves with this people in order to become worshipers and participants in a relationship with that same God would fall under the commands of those laws. But it had been. But he's not referring to that. He's referring to that it had been. You've heard that it was given. So you could not even be subscribing to the commandments, and you would have heard about these commandments, and still Jesus would be speaking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've covered that. Now, so let's see. The idea that they had heard the statement with their own ears, how is it active? They had heard with their own ears and understandings that it had been commanded. So they participated in an active way with it. And I've already talked about that, which essentially means that they knew that this law had been declared by God at Mount Sinai to the people of Israel, his audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now here's the statement. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Rather cryptic, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
If you heard that and you didn't know anything more about it, you would say, okay, this is, we're talking now in puzzles. What do they call it when you talk in puzzles? It's called, there's a word for it. I can't think of it. You know what I'm saying, don't you?
I do, but I can't.
Yeah, isn't that awful? Riddle.
A riddle.
Riddle.
Yeah,
riddle. Riddle, riddle, riddle.
Yeah.
Riddle. So, it sounds like a riddle. But, as always, when Jesus or anyone in Scripture is talking to someone else, to a specific audience, or to a general audience, or to a group of people, there is a certain amount of knowledge that they already possess.
Yes.
And we do it all the time. If I say I'm going to Marshall's, you immediately know it's a department store, is it not? I mean, Marshall's. Mm-hmm. I'm going to Sears.
Oh, yeah.
Sears.
Yeah.
Anybody not knowing that would say, Sears. Is that where they brand you with a iron? like a tattoo parlor? Or, you know, I mean, being ridiculous, but that's okay. So you get the point. The key word in the two short statements, one, an eye for an eye, second statement, and a tooth for a tooth, is ante. It's a preposition used with the genitive. And it's used here with the genitive, and originally means opposite, ante. Anti-aircraft missile.
Oh.
Anti-tank ballistics.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-septic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
What's septic mean? Think of a septic tank.
What is a septic?
If you look at a septic tank, what do you see? Well, let's not to be too vivid
bacteria
here.
Bacteria.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's septic. It's like yuck, yuck, yuck. So antiseptic goes against the yuck, yuck,
yeah,
and keeps you from being infected.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Antiseptic.
Antiseptic.
Okay, so let's see. Well, you know, anti-social behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Opposite.
Anti.
Going against the... Okay, so you got that. Now, anti can be anti-Christ. And it really has a lot to do with being over on the other side of something. It is opposite as to sides. You know, over against. Antichrist is the pseudo Christ, the false Christ,
mm-hmm,
the one who may try to appear to be the same, but is effectively and really opposite.
Yeah.
Okay. So it can be used for in place of Antichrist, in place of, instead of, in behalf of, or because of. So it has a
pretty good... So insert those into that sentence. Like, I'm not...
Okay.
So like where is that key word? Which word is that?
Anti. It would be...
like just put it in place.
For.
Oh, okay.
So go ahead.
No, an eye in place of an eye. No, I got it. I just wasn't...
Okay.
Sure.
An eye instead of an eye.
Or instead of behalf.
In behalf of an eye. Because of an eye. And, you know, in each case we have to add other... We know the thought, so we have to expand it if we're talking about it. We would say in place of the eye.
But then what would you like for instead of? Obviously, I guess that one wouldn't...
Yes, it kind of would.
An eye instead of an eye? And a tooth instead of a tooth?
Okay, instead of... In place... In when it's in the idea of in place of, instead of a tooth. Yeah, that's a little...
No, I know,
little awkward, and it wouldn't fit well, but the idea...
Right. That's a...
Okay, so the implication is that if someone takes your eye, you are justified under the law to take their eye. That's the implication, is it not?
Yes.
The best translation of this cryptic statement is an eye in place of an eye and a tooth in place of a tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, next page, 2. The question this should provoke is, who is given the authority to administer such punishment? The victim or a court?
Oh.
Yeah. Ah. Big difference, because if we think in terms, if we take it at face value, no pun intended, that we, if someone takes your eye, the payment for that eye is the other's eye, the one that took it.
Yes.
Instead of your eye, their eye. See, so that would instead would have that characteristic. So absence of any qualification, it might seem as though the Mosaic Law encouraged vengeful acts of retaliation in order to pay back offensive acts with equally offensive acts. Well, you took my eye, I am justified to gouge out your eye. And that would be a comparable, that vengeance would be comparable in type and intensity, as in the order of tit for tat, which means this for that. Mentally, we often see in military conflicts between nations. For example, you bomb our capital, we bomb your capital. No more, no less.
But see, this brings me to the point that I was saying that I was, you know, kind of was reading about, where it was, I mean, we view it as, you know, vengeful, but it, but like I said, it's regulating it in a way. It's like you bomb our capital,
we don't,
and normally we're going to go back, we're going to bomb everything you have. We're going to kill all your people.
We take you off
right.
the map.
And this is, well, remember, what was it? What was the book? I know you read it. With the bombers, the sack bombers. It's like some book everybody reads in high school. And something burns out and they can't turn back.
Oh.
And they're trying to convince... Remember that? It's not Catch 21. Well, anyway, that's what happened. Like, because they were trying to tell everybody and they're trying to get them to turn around and come back. And they passed the point of... You know, right.
Yeah.
And
no communication.
That's it. And so they ended up blowing up Moscow. And then what happened is we ended up, instead of a whole full-out nuclear war, like they blew up one of our cities with that name. It was... I have to find that. You know the name of the book. It's like a...
Well, that's exactly what we would have here, right? And so... But the main question is still it exists. Who has that right to do that? Is it the victim or a court?
Right.
Now in Exodus 21:1 we read, "Now these are the judgments These are the judgments which you shall set before them." So this is a judgment. And a judgment always takes a judge, right? Because the judgment is the result of the act of a judge. That's what a judgment is. Now in Exodus 21:22 we have this: "If men fight and hurt a woman with child." Now what's that mean, for example? That means that she's
pregnant.
Exactly. "With child" means pregnant. Okay. "So that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine." Now see, we have a more than one judge here.
Yeah.
Judges determine. Or as a judge in this case, and a judge in the next case, judges plural, not necessarily meaning that there are several judges presiding. That means sequential or serial judging, you know, cases. Serial cases. "But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life." Now, this can be a kinky question. Who is assumed to have been harmed?
The
child, the wife, or the husband? if men fight and hurt a woman with child, she's pregnant, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows. It sounds like the child, doesn't it?
Yes.
Premature. And no harm follows, meaning that the child lives.
Yes.
This is here a case against abortion. Fight or no fight. Right? Okay, so anyway. Let's go on. Exodus 21:24. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now we have an expansion of this thing. Burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Wow.
Yeah.
So that would be ophthalmos, anti ophthalmon. No, genitive. Ophthalmos. Eye against over. Eye against. Eye. What do I want to say? Eye for. But I in place of an eye, a tooth in place of a tooth, etc., etc. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant, now here is something we're entering into that we are not used to, the idea of master-servant relationship.
Yes.
We're not used to that.
No.
So we look at all of these things having to do generally with people of equal status or whatever, but not in the sense of master, servant, bond slave, slave, whatever. So we have to adapt our thinking to be inclusive in this. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, meaning the eye, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye.
Shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. What is that? He shall go free if he give up his eye. Is that his eye? Okay.
Yeah.
So for the sake of his eye.
You say you. We know the eye for eye, this is an exception then. With this relationship, this is what I'm trying to point out.
So what? So if the
that this
child
law,
dies in the womb, you get to kill their kid. Is that what he's...
Well...
Not kill their kid, but...
No.
That's
not what it's doing. This is just showing that an eye in place of the eye has been modified here when there, with the exception of a servant to master relationship. And the only reason I'm bringing this out here is because it is part of the eye for eye thing, but it's a modification of it. And then we want to see what kind of relationship then is Jesus talking about. When is he talking about eye for an eye, or is he talking about master slave relationship?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. So let's go on. Having said that, we'll put it, as we say, on the back burner. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, now we've moved from the eye to the tooth, he shall let him go free. Why? For the sake of his tooth. So the master didn't get his eye taken out because he removed the eye, he harmed the eye of the other one. He didn't get his tooth knocked out because he knocked out the tooth of another. By a court penalty. Now the rest is, well, let's just read it anyway, because if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. So there's no value, there's no salvaged value from that. Nobody enjoys this gets enjoyment from this situation. That's how I would look at that is.
Yeah.
This is not something that we celebrate and say, oh, the steaks are particularly excellent. Oh yeah, well this is the animal that had gored the Joneses over there. And I didn't know that. You know, whatever. But the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. You're okay. All right. This happens. It happens. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past, and it had been made known to his owner, and he had not kept it confined so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. Yikes.
That would be the old law, yes.
So that pit bull that is known to attack people, maybe has bit a couple people, now kills someone, and so we destroy the animal and then destroy the owner too.
Mm-hmm.
How do you like that one?
That'd be a lot less. That going on today.
It seems like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's a zinger in here that we need to face it, and we'll come to it pretty soon here. So, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life. Okay, but you can buy your way out if you can afford to pay the sum of money. To redeem yourself, whatever is imposed upon him. So there's this flexible.
Yes.
But who makes that decision? The judge.
The judge
makes it. So whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. Now Leviticus 24:19. If a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor, as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. Okay, so now we have the same eye for an eye as a malicious act of disfigurement. Doesn't say what the relationship. But if there was a purposeful... Now, the other one is, if he could... the obvious thing is that the master struck.
Yes.
And there was secondary damage. The eye was injured to the point of being ruined, lost. In this case, causing disfigurement seems like it would be a purposeful act of, well, now I'm going to show you, I'll just break your arm. And like, whoa, it shall be done to them. And whoever kills an animal shall restore it. Okay, I killed your cow, so here's another one. But whoever kills a man shall be put to death. You shall have the same law for the stranger. Now the stranger, who is the stranger to? Well, the stranger was anybody outside of the community.
Right.
In this case,
yeah.
In case it extended, it wasn't the difference between a Jew and a Gentile. It would have been, although it probably started off that way, didn't it?
Yeah, it would have.
Yeah, it would have started off that way. Stranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, within the community, if this happened, the stranger had no... I have diplomatic immunity. Not. You abide by the same laws. And for one from your own country, for I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and they took outside the camp him who had cursed. Wow. Cursed. Stoned him with stones. So the children of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. So cursing was punishable by death.
Yes.
Deuteronomy 19:15. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. The key word is one.
One
witness shall not rise. One is not sufficient. Should be obvious why.
Yes.
Although many teachers have lost their jobs and their reputation because I'm thinking about a specific thing, and it could go the other way,
sure.
But I know that, so I'm not trying to be sexist here. But I'm just saying, he touched me inappropriately, or whatever, and maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But there are many times when he didn't, and the one witness,
yes.
Later she says, because I've known situations like this, I've heard the daughter said, the woman said, the girl says later, well, he really didn't do it. I was just mad at him because he did some, you know, he just didn't give me the grade that I wanted, or he didn't, you know, he didn't acknowledge me in
the
proper way, and blah, 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 blah.
I
showed him.
We've gone too far with this anti-thing of law, and the thing is, according to biblical law, you have to be at least two witnesses to establish.
Yeah, and I would hate to have a situation arise, you know, where something inappropriate did happen.
Yeah, no, but I get.
And
I get
somebody
point,
took
though.
Advantage,
I mean,
you know. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay, but now Jesus, I immediately think of Jesus here because
yeah.
He was falsely accused.
Yeah.
They paid witnesses to go against him.
Yes.
His trial was totally illegal.
It was.
The up and down, it was bad, bad, bad. And yet, he did not fight it.
No.
Because this was the will of the Father. Now, it's difficult for us to put... We're not the Savior. For us to put ourselves in His shoes under, you know, those circumstances, because we wouldn't categorically fit into that. But it's a lot to think about.
Yeah, I didn't. Nuts. It's like this is wrong.
He's falsely
in prison. You know, these guys are in prison for like 20.
True.
I mean that. I don't know how they could survive, just, you know, where he just knows. I mean, that's just God's will, so, I mean, he's going to fulfill everything, but just,
yeah, I know,
once you're in your mind, it's like,
yeah,
you guys are all making a mockery of this whole justice thing here, you know, which you take so seriously, and here you are.
So, I guess my point is that, even looking at this, I have a greater appreciation for Christ's obedience.
Oh, yeah.
By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord. So even though it is going to be on a worldly level, temporal level, it's going to be wrong, there is payment due. The false witnesses will stand before the Lord. And so those witnesses that falsely accused him,
oh yeah,
they didn't get away with a thing.
No.
So, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days, and the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness, he who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. Wow. That's, isn't that something? They were thinking to do it to him.
Oh yeah.
And they shall have it done. He shall have it done unto him.
Mm-hmm.
So you shall put away the evil from among you, and those who remain shall hear and fear. And hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. Now your eye, here's where your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. There we have it.
Now, what does that mean, your eye shall not pity?
You don't look at this situation and say, oh, that's pitiful. Don't do that. You know, spare them. I mean, it's harsh.
It's hardcore justice.
Yeah. Harsh stuff. Deuteronomy 25:11. If two men fight together, this I could leave out, but I'm going to put it in here just because it has the eye. But just to show you some of the law. If two men fight together and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him, you get the scenario, right?
Yeah.
And puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall not pity her. So
right
there,
to me.
There you go. Whoa. Yeah. Okay. So we'll just pass that through. Now, 39. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. This is Jesus speaking. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Now, here's what this is saying. But I tell you, ego de lego humin, which means the de is but. Ego, I. Lego, tell. Am telling humin to you. I am telling to you. The I is emphatic. It's not necessary. So I am telling you. So the emphasis on Jesus, once again,
yes,
that he is the one who's saying this. Now, he is deity, so he has every right to,
yes,
to do this. And he says not to resist an evil person. Here's what it says. May anti stenai to panero. Okay, that means the idea of not to resist, the negative may is used here for not. It is the softer, let's say that, softer of the two Greek words for not. U and may. We've talked about this before, so this should become quite easy for us. The may is the one. U is the door is closed and locked. Absolutely not. May is the door is closed, but it's not locked. It's subject to being changed in the future or some. I don't want to say that it's circumstantial, because I don't want to get into circumstantial, but circumstance does play a factor in the law.
So it's not saying somebody's slapping you. Don't be a dope. Don't just stand there. I don't know.
So the implication that I see here is that the statement Jesus is making is not absolute in all instances. The door is closed, but not locked. There is room for variation or exception based on what might be presumed to be wise judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to resist. Now, here's what's going on here. The word to resist, if you look at that, it is antistenai. To resist. You notice the anti in there?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is stenai, which is the infinitive form, and built on the morph sta, S-T-A. Mm-hmm. Sta means to stand.
Okay.
In opposition to.
Yeah.
So stand, to stand in opposition to. This is a compound word consisting of the morph sta, to stand, and anti, over against. The implication is that the first response to an actively evil person, to panero. Now, when I say that, does this translation say an evil person? Yes, it does.
It does.
But what we have to look at here is there are two aspects of evil. There are actually two different words for evil. One is paneros, and the other is kakos. Kakos, I don't have it in the notes. Kakos is general evil.
Okay.
Evil in general. Paneros is particular evil. Particular evil, active evil. Evil in the process. So what this is saying is, it's another, evil is an adjective.
So was that like evil of kind of like intent,
sort of?
Well, let's think about this. What it's saying is,
like, I could do something wrong to you, but then if I know I'm doing something wrong to you, I mean, is that...
It's not referring to evil people in general.
Okay.
It's referring to an evil act that could be done by anybody. The focal point is not the evil person, the idea of the characteristic of evil. It's the idea of the evil act. This is an evil act. This is a person who is doing evil.
Yeah.
There's probably no reason to dwell on the difference, except that I want to point out that sometimes scripture refers to evil in general, and then sometimes it's specific. This is specific evil. Evil in action. You can see it happening. It's right there. It's not just evil thinking. It's evil, an evil act. So this person is an actively evil person in doing what they're doing. Okay, they're acting out the evil. They're acting out evil. Do not resist a person acting out evil. That's what it's saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the implication is that the first response to an actively evil person, or a person doing active evil to you, is to not immediately draw yourself up into a defensive posture or stance. Stand off against it. You see that? It's subtle. But it's saying, don't fly off the handle over it. Your first response is not to, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But there's another response that Jesus is suggesting. It will all make sense when we cover this. There seems to be some wise psychology coming from Jesus on this matter, where he is teaching us a counterintuitive approach to dealing with an evil acting person in this specific evil that they're doing. We have, and we'll see what that is here.
I've always interpreted this as, because I'm always thinking, you know, Jesus is, he's always like
principles, you know, like, well, you know, like the, you know, he wants to go, like, what's the whole point? What's the principle behind it? So if somebody smacks you on the cheek, I interpret it as, what he's saying is, you know, take a break there, and not necessarily go, oh, like this, but in your mind, you're going to like, well, how am I going to do this differently? That's how I see it. Like, it's a mental way of, instead of, like you said, rearing up and punching the guy, it's, well, I'm going to turn the other cheek. It's like, I'm going to change my mind for a second, and I'm going to whatever, do whatever. I mean, maybe you are going to punch the guy or not, but it's, I don't know, I just don't see it like cheek to cheek. I see it's more of like a mindset. It's like, turn, what would you normally not do? You know,
well, okay, so it is, you agree, it's counterintuitive.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, normally I would do this,
normally,
but I'm going to
normally,
think,
this is a,
you know,
this is a stopgap.
Right.
This is like,
that's
I'm not going to, I'm not reacting in an ordinary human way.
Right.
I'm taking a step here that is unusual.
That's how I see it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, okay, good. We're on the same track then. Now, apparently a person, by the way, what I did on this is I searched as much out as I could just from the words that were being said, and then I did some research. I like to do it that way. I rather than to go to research and find out what somebody else says and say, oh yeah, I agree with that. Well, let's put that in here. I like to make a stab at it.
Yeah,
myself.
That's what we do.
That's what we do. Right.
You
know? So that's the way we're approaching this. So apparently a person who is trying to perpetuate an evil act against us expects us to take an immediate stance. That's expected.
Yeah.
To resist him out of our fear. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, you know, does the slapping thing there. Now, the slapping, you will find this very interesting. What the words have to say about what's going on here themselves. How much information the words themselves give us. Perhaps when we do not display fear, we temporarily diffuse the situation by removing some of the fundamental motive of the perpetrator for the evil act in the first place. Why would they do that? They intend to frighten us with this act,
yeah,
to provoke a confrontation. Maybe they want us to take a swing at them, provoke at, you know, to get us riled up and to do this. So it seems to me that the wisdom in this approach has to do with removing ourselves from the game aspect of the evil by depriving the perp of some of the most appealing value from the situation. Could be entertainment and control of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
They're in control until we do something different. This strategy also gives the perp time to think twice about what he's actually doing. He struck you, we turn the cheek. What's up with that? To elevate the potential conflict from the physiological and reactive sphere of behavior to a higher order of the mental and the thinking sphere of behavior. And to give us time to think through a better strategy or possibly a less dangerous solution. You know, that's some other possibilities.
That's pretty funny, though, because I love to argue about stuff. Right? That's why it's sort of like entertainment, whatever. And I mean that really hits home, because I'm just, a lot of times, you know, I just want to see what the other person thinks. But if I'm saying something to them and it really riles them up, and then when they don't want to engage me, then I'm like, well, hey, what's, you know, and it throws me for a loop. So this is,
you for a loop.
You know, because I'm like, come on, let's get it on. I want to hear what you have to, and the person's like, no, I'm not going to deal with that. And that drives me crazy. I'm like, no.
So there's a diffusing.
Yes.
What else scripture says about this? This is separate from that, but you answer a harsh word with a, it, you ever play tennis?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have, yeah.
No, I haven't, but yeah.
Okay, but you've seen it played.
I've seen it played.
If somebody hits the ball very hard at you, the best, so you want to swing to a full swing and hit the ball back. Now, you know, for every action there's an opposite and equal reaction. So this ball is coming at you at 60 miles an hour, and you whack it, it leaves with the potential that it came into that racket, plus the potential you add to it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it is, but it's going to go out of bounds. But if you want to slow the game down, all you have to do is let the ball, just hold your racket up there, let it bounce off, and then go just over the net.
Yeah.
And they've got to struggle to get to the net. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking of soccer right now. When, you know, my brother, I'm not a big soccer fan, but somebody kicks the ball really hard at you, and what you do is, boom, you take it and you trap it, you know. And
there you go.
You take all the energy, but then
you
got
it.
It's right there. Now you can do what
now
you want with it.
Now you have control. But you see the control.
But if you were like, oh, you know, if you went right at it, you just hit it, boom, you know.
You're out of control, and that's control. So you answer a harsh word with a soft answer. That's scriptural. And that way you diffuse the situation. So there's a lot going on here that we can apply. Okay, so anyhow. So what does the evil acting person expect you to do after he drives the palm of his hand into your right cheek? Now the reason I say he drives the palm of his hand into your right cheek, I'm actually asking the question, but I want us to begin thinking about what's going on here. So we'll continue.
But wait, you go talk, remember how we talk about like the right eye and this and that? So I'm going to think like the right cheek. So like it's my good, I don't know, part of me, you know, whatever, the good part. If somebody hits me really hard on that part where I'm supposed to try to be nice or whatever, I don't know.
It's not as metaphorical.
Okay.
It's not as metaphorical. But it does, but it tells us a lot about what's going on here, and you will see this. Most people are right-handed.
Yes.
Does this imply a strike from the back of the hand? If you get hit on the right cheek by a person standing eyeball to eyeball to you, how are they going to hit you? They're right-handed, too. How are they gonna use their right hand to hit you on the right cheek? It's not a trick question.
No.
No, I like that.
It is a backhand. So let's keep that in mind. This is exactly what the scripture is saying. It has always been, most people are right-handed. A statement like this is going to be, it's not going to be dealt with a left-handed person. It's going to be the most common situation. And Jesus is saying, if a person drives the back of his hand into your cheek. Now, it does say that, into your right cheek. And it uses the word into. It's ace. It's not... at your cheek, it is into your cheek. So the idea is driving the back of the hand, the knuckles, the back of the hand into your cheek, your right cheek. Now, okay, so then we ask this question, and we can do rightfully so, it's investigative. What is the historic connotation of a backhanded strike or a backhanded manner of doing anything? According to Merriam-Webster's thesaurus, backhanded means not being or expressing what one appears to be expressing as an action which is basically insincere. If the motive of the evil acting person who strikes another with the back of his hand can be said to contain any element of insincerity. Perhaps the main reason for the act is to demonstrate some kind of superiority.
Yeah.
He's not sincere. He's not interested in actually causing harm. Otherwise, he'd take his right hand and just pop you one, a good one. He'd give it to you all the way.
Yeah.
There's a certain insincerity about a backhanded thrust. Now, you may or may not agree with me. That's not important. But you see that there is something about a backhanded thrust. There is some element of insincerity in it.
Oh, I don't know. I think of it. It's like a...
If you want to hurt somebody...
It's like when someone takes off a glove.
Exactly.
And like,
okay, now you're talking.
It's like, what did you... You know, it's worse.
Right.
It's worse than if somebody
it's
clocked you.
It's intimidating.
It's like, why don't you just...
If you wanted to hit me, hit me straight
like,
on. Hit me in the left cheek with your right hand, the strength. Use all of your strength to knock me out. But this idea of coming at me with the back of the hand, there is something going on there that is not, you know. Okay, so anyhow, perhaps the main reason for the act is to demonstrate superiority. Control. Dominance and the power to lash out against an inferior. All factors that would boost one's ego but not cause a great deal of actual physical harm.
Yeah.
Right? So the insincere, the idea that it's short of really doing any damage, it's more of an act of a superior. If the receive, if the receiver turns an exposed left cheek to the perpetrator, in the process, the sincerity of the perpetrator is challenged. You turn the other cheek. Now, here's the thing, too, that hasn't entered into this, that will later. Maybe I should leave it for later, but you have to remember that the left hand in any, just about any nationality except the United States, is used for what purpose?
As an instep.
Yeah, and why is the left hand so... hesitant to be used in any other in many, many third world cultures?
Well, it represents weakness, right?
Well, there's more than that. It's
hand.
A very common term, and the absurdity of it will hit you immediately. It's what they use to wipe their rear ends with, actually. It is how they cleanse themselves after they had... I hate to say it like this, but this is the fact.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it. The left hand is the dirty hand. Okay? And there is a reserve that everybody holds back in these other nations, anything having to do with the left hand. You don't grab another left hand, a person's left hand and kiss it or something like that. I mean, it is like, oh my gosh, you animal! You nasty it is reserved. And it really is. And they really do. Believe me. We know firsthand, no pun intended. No pun taken. Okay, so anyhow, let's go on to that. It seems like I'm trying to gross you out, but I'm not.
These are just
actual facts. This is facts of life.
People take it.
And Martin Luther said, call a spade a spade, and that's not what he said. I won't even repeat what he said when he said that statement. But the Bible says it straight out. I mean, sometimes indirectly,
Jesus does. Kind of ruffles our feathers, you know.
Gives it to you straight out. Okay, so now... So let me go on to that. So the other cheek, so in other words, if you turn the right cheek, then you turn the left cheek, you're inviting the same kind of movement from the other hand. If If a person strikes you with the back of their hand, which is implied here, and you turn the other cheek, you're inviting them to use their left reserved hand to strike you in the same manner. Or you're inviting them to escalate the harm and hit you full force with their right hand.
Mm.
This is the reality of this situation. They have to think about that. Do they want to hit you with that reserved hand? Is this so important now that they want to use that dirty hand to smack you again? I mean, it would be shameful for them and for you, beyond what they've already done. Their purpose has already been met by. So they're now in a position of making up a whole different decision. You've put a burden on them by doing this, and I'm not exaggerating. This is exactly what's going on here. Okay, let me go on. So the other cheek offered presents an abrupt shift from the response expected by the perp and subsequently serves as an element of surprise added to the mix. The perp is now forced to think of what he's actually doing. What am I doing? From the perspective of whether another strike would accomplish his original goal. At any rate, there is something going on here involving the psychology of human nature that obviously demonstrates Jesus' genius on the subject. The question remains, can this example of this particular technique be extended beyond face slapping? Can we take this principle as a fundamental operative principle that would apply to all kinds of malicious abuses in general?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
I'm asking the question because I don't think so.
Oh.
I don't think so.
Why don't you think so?
Well, now, I'm going to call for some help. But I'm going to Wikipedia.
No.
For the help.
All right.
And we look here. Now, we're going to get a lot of stuff before we get to our other thing. But we won't take long. What time? How are we doing on time?
8:30.
That's good. That'll be about right. Historical origins. Some hold that Jesus, while rejecting an eye for an eye, built upon previous Jewish ethical teachings of the Tanakh. That is the ancient.
Isn't that commentary?
No, Tanakh is just the law. It would just be the first five books of the Bible. It would be the.
The Pentateuch.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew that.
You will not exact vengeance on or bear any sort of grudge against the members of your people, but will love your fellow as yourself. That's Leviticus 19:18, called the Great Commandment. The idea of offering one's cheek to a smiter is also seen in Lamentations 3:30, where the context indicates a form of penitence or submission to oppressors with the hope of being spared. So I don't know how that fits together. I'm just giving you that information. An analogous sentiment is spoken by Socrates in his conversation with Crito in 399 BC before his execution at Athens. He says, one should never do wrong in return, nor mistreat any man, no matter how one has been mistreated by him. This moral guides Socrates in his arguments to a conclusion that he should not attempt to escape from punishment despite being wrongfully imprisoned, etc. Okay.
Psycho. I was reading Socrates' Apology, and then Crito's second part where he's in prison, and just reading that. It's awesome. I'm glad you just put it in there. I mean,
just because it was in Wikipedia. Let's get a bigger.
But it just jogs some things. That's just cool.
Now the interpretations. This phrase as much as of the Sermon on the Mount has been subjected to both literal and figurative interpretations. Straightforward interpretation. In everyday speech, the phrase turn the other cheek is often used to mean something like turn away from aggression and ignore it rather than retaliate. Morality lessons that teach turning the other cheek as a good or Christian value would typically emphasize nonviolence and non-confrontation. The most straightforward reading of the passage in Matthew and Luke, however, suggests that the phrase has a more radical meaning. A command to respond to aggression by willingly exposing oneself to a further act of aggression rather than retaliating, retreating, and ignoring. Definitely not, it's not a passive movement. It is quite an aggressive, it's passive aggressive. Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, but it is doing something out of convention, out of the expected. There's a surprise element. I mean, this is amazing, this thing. Now, literal interpretation is this. A literal interpretation of the passages in which the command refers specifically to a manual strike against the side of a person's face can be supported by reference to historical and other factors. Now, here's where I think, you notice I put this little asterisk here? Because I think now we're getting to it. And I find it very interesting that Wikipedia, whoever has, you know, made their entries into this, has captured this. At the time of Jesus, striking someone deemed to be of a lower class with the back of the hand was used to assert authority and dominance. It was not an uncommon thing. So when Jesus spoke of it, many had in mind the master-servant mentality. Okay? So what I'm saying is, if this is universally intended by Jesus as a operative principle, it certainly has to do with someone. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a servant master situation relationship, but the person identifies themselves by using the back of the hand in such a way as making themselves to become more superior. Uh-huh. It is a backhanded thrust, just like you say, using the glove and all this. It's a move of someone who thinks that they are superior, who is putting themselves in that position. In that sense, it is universal. Okay? Uh-huh. So if somebody is, and that could fit a lot of circumstances, definitely. But you don't have to be their servant. They think you're their servant. A husband who thinks his wife is a servant is going to make this kind of move, backhanded slap. You see what I'm saying? It was common then. It is common today.
Yeah.
This is what Jesus is referring to. Someone who's setting themselves. Okay, so they're trying to assert authority and dominance, whether they have it or not. They think they have it. They have that right. If the persecuted person turned the other cheek, the discipliner was faced with a dilemma. Here's the key word. This was the word that I was, in the back of my mind, was looking for, and I didn't find it in my, it's in my vocabulary, but it didn't come to the surface. It came to the surface when I read, as I'm reading this Wikipedia, and I thought, well, that's very helpful then. Because that's the word I was looking for. It creates that moment of dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a dilemma is?
Yes.
Okay. It, you know, I'm counting the cost. If I do it this way, if I do it this way, what's going to happen? Either way. And usually with a dilemma, the outcome is not positive in either way.
Mm-hmm.
But when you turn the other cheek, you're putting the person into this new dilemma. They hadn't counted on this. The left hand was used for unclean purposes. We've already discussed that. And that's the only reason I discussed it before. Not to gross you out, but to prepare you for this. So a backhanded strike on the opposite cheek would not typically be performed. You see that they wouldn't, they would reserve that hand as like, not even in even in my sense of superiority am I going to use that hand. In our society, we don't have that kind of a thing.
No.
So anyhow, the other alternative would be a slap with the open hand as a challenge or to punch a person.
Mm-hmm.
See, that would be the only thing left, is use the right hand as an open slap to that exposed cheek, or use full out a less insincere punch straight out. But this was seen as a statement of equality. Dwell on that for a minute. We don't understand that right away, do we?
Look, you got some servant or whatever, you do something.
Or the person that you put in your mind as a servant.
Right. But I mean, if you think you're superior and suddenly you're going to do something where you're equal, you're not going to do that.
So if you give the punch on the right, then that person is being treated as an equal rather than a subordinate. And that's a dilemma you're faced with. Thus, by turning the other cheek, the persecuted was in effect demanding equality. Okay, so that's the end of that idea. So now we have to, you know, what it brings out in our thinking is that if we think that turning the other cheek is just a sheepish way of dealing with the matter, it is not. It's a highly sophisticated matter of dealing with this, with someone who. But you've got to have.
Makes me think of meekness.
Yeah, and you've got to have somebody who's trying to be superior to you in this case, and it is a very finesse kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to think this way, clearly, when you're being, slapped around it like this. And treated as an inferior. But it also means now if the person takes a punch, you have equalized the situation if they go ahead and punch you. Now, what happens beyond that, I don't know. You going to take him and shoot him or what? I don't know. Jesus doesn't deal with it beyond that. But there are some... I believe a person has a right to defend themselves. You see? And a person who strikes you, even if they think that they are superior, they are now no longer superior.
Yes.
Now, do you retaliate? That's up to you. I don't know. Jesus doesn't speak to that.
Yes. I mean, I can also see it. I think about turn the other cheek. We're talking about changing your mindset. Maybe the person who did whatever they did, maybe they did it out of ignorance, or maybe they were just angry. So this just goes into what you're saying. You calculate, well, you know what? Maybe I will just take that slap because this person is just had a bad day.
But you have equalized the situation, and even if you take
by understanding that maybe they're not being themselves, or maybe somebody died and now they're in a bad mood. But what I'm saying is, so now
they've already disqualified them. Actually, no action beyond that is necessary. If that is your issue, the goal is to put them in their place, and it may be a situation where it's worth taking the pain.
It's
in order to accomplish that goal with that person,
exactly.
That your relationship with that
exactly.
person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, okay, good.
Good.
Now, by handing over one's cloak in addition to one's tunic, the debtor has essentially given the shirt off their back.
Yes.
A situation directly forbidden by Hebrew law, as stated in Deuteronomy 24:10-13. You know that if you loan a neighbor your shirt, they're supposed to give it back to you before when you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not. Oh, well, this is a different thing. We'd have to read Deuteronomy 24:10-11 to appreciate this. But the idea is that you give it back to them before nightfall, so that they don't freeze to death and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge. You shall remain outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. If he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you. There's the deal.
Okay.
And it will be righteous for you before the Lord your God. By giving the lender the cloak as well, the debtor was reduced to nakedness, and public nudity was viewed as bringing shame to the viewer, not to the naked. Now, this is a cultural thing we don't even understand.
No.
But this was going on, and this is what Jesus was speaking to about this idea. I don't want to spend any more time on that, but you can dwell with that
uh-huh.
as you see fit. The succeeding verse from the Sermon on the Mount can similarly be seen as the method for making the oppressor break the law. Here's the thing. The commonly invoked Roman law of Angaria allowed the Roman authorities to demand the inhabitants to occupy territories that carry messages and equipment the distance of 1 mile post. That was, they could do that. They could, but prohibited forcing an individual to go farther or further. They say further, it's farther. Farther than a single mile, at the risk of suffering disciplinary action. So in this example, the nonviolent interpretation sees Jesus as placing criticism on an unjust and hated Roman law, as well as clarifying the teaching to extend beyond Jewish law. This was a double-edged sword he was handling here. As a side effect, this may also have afforded the earlier followers a longer time to minister to the soldier or to cause the soldier not to seek followers of Jesus. This is kind of a cynical approach, to carry his equipment in the future so as not to be bothered with their proselytizing. It's like you make a nuisance of yourself. Now, I don't know if I don't agree with that, but I don't think Jesus was saying, make a nuisance of yourself and they won't bother you anymore. But he was saying, offer to go farther. But the double-edged sword of that, if they did that and they were so bent on, you know, using you that way, it was to their own risk. Because they couldn't make you go another mile.
I thought about this. If you do it for a mile, all right, they're making you do it.
Right.
You go 2 miles. Now you're choosing that. I got some control here. You know
exactly. Control has changed.
I mean, it's weird.
Exactly.
It's weird, but
it's weird.
Have you go a mile, and you're like, you know what? I'm gonna go a little further. You know. I don't know. It gives you a little, something changes there when you suddenly don't get too much
into
that.
It's another form of equalizing. Now, I think we could probably take this and extrapolate a, a, a general principle that is not culturally encased. But the idea of equalization to this process would be, something to really study over.
But it's all about that with relationships and anger.
Yeah.
It's all about
your
ego and there you go and backing down and not backing down and I'm going to, it's almost all fights and brawl.
It is the new power of meekness that Jesus brings to the scene. The new power of meekness.
Like a power.
It's not a mamny-pamny, mansy-pamsy thing. It is the change in the control. I mean, you are shifting things here in a very unexpected, there's a surprise. Look at the elements that are unexpected, unconventional, counterintuitive, surprise element, shift, creating a new dilemma for somebody. They expect you to go a certain way, and you defy that in a unique and meek manner that, somebody that's not just an absolute brute would have to be affected by that.
Yes.
So it has its effect.
The thing is, but it has an effect on that person, though,
yeah,
that you're doing it. I mean, I would just say that guy's a brute and just say he's like, oh, good, I got 2 miles out of him.
It's a shameful thing, but for you, it's like,
it doesn't bother me, man. You don't even get it, in a way. I'm not even derogatory, but you know what I'm saying?
You steal the thunder.
You steal the value, you steal the motive,
you steal the entertainment value. You take all that away, and they're really left with nothing. And it's really quite remarkable.
I don't like to demean it by talking about like these psychological principles, but whatever. That's how we think, psychology.
I think our mental life is our life. They're genius psychological things that are coming from Jesus.
But I mean, mental life is life.
Who knows more of human nature? So if we listen to Jesus very carefully, there's a lot of insight there. Okay, so I think that's enough for today, huh?
Just cut that last little.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can read that. So.
Yeah. Okay, end it.